You're listening to WBH Radio. I'm your host, William Holly. This is episode 58. We have a big-time guest joining us today. I'm very excited. I'm also a little bit nervous. You know, usually when I do these podcasts with guests, I can hang my hat on being one of the three, right? Either I'm one of the more experienced individuals on the mic, or I have a better grasp of history, you know, maybe a little bit more well-read, or I'm the better basketball player. In this case, my guest has me beat on all three accounts. He played in the ABA, the NBA. He was an All-American at the University of Maryland. He is a Harvard-educated lawyer, former Brooklyn prosecutor, senior lecturer at Columbia University, longtime color commentator, covering college basketball, the great, honorable, intrepid, gallant Mr. Len Elmore. Mr. Elmore, welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, thanks, William. It's a pleasure. And you probably can take me on the floor now.
I went back and forth about which areas I wanted to go with you. And finally, I came to the conclusion that my first question was going to be, well, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I mean, I've been blessed, you know, healthy and happy, busy, you know, just all of those things are important. And, you know, I have purpose and, you know, I'm just glad to be here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Excellent. Where are you joining us from today?
Well, I am in the state of Maryland right now. You know, we live in New York City, as well as obviously teaching at Columbia University in proximity. But, you know, we have a residence here in Maryland, in Howard County, and, you know, isolated a bit from civilization. So we had to do that over the last year or so based on the pandemic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Staying safe, staying out of the way. Mr. Elmore, did you call any college basketball games this past season?
Yeah, fortunately, keep my hand in. I was given an opportunity by the Big Ten Network to call games actually from home. We had a setup where I could do it remotely, set it up in my what I call my media room. That's the room where I have a big screen TV and such. But they sent all the equipment necessary, and you know, I was able to do games from home, which was interesting. Required even more focus, but nevertheless, it was equally as fun. You know, not as much fun as if you were among the crowd there live, but it certainly, you know, it had its advantages staying away from folks. So,
why would you say it required more focus? Just not being on the court to be able to see the game yourself, having to rely on television cameras?
Yeah, and more than anything else, to be able to just rely on what you saw on the monitors instead of what you saw live. And, you know, there are so many other stimuli out there on the floor that you don't have when you're sitting in your little room. Right. But, you know, and it requires more observation, more understanding. But nevertheless, as I said, it was enjoyable.
This was a college season like no other because of the pandemic. Some places there weren't fans. The Ivy League opted not to play. What stands out to you about the season? Anything, the gameplay, the players, the coaching. What's something you'll remember about this past college basketball season, men's college basketball season?
Well, I would have to tip my hat to the young men and women who played the games and the mental toughness required. You know, you have to generate your own energy when there are no fans out there or very few fans. And particularly during tournament time when, you know, people were relegated to, you know, the isolated conditions. Some people call it a bubble. Some people call it not quite a bubble. but nevertheless, you're there, you're isolated. The only people around you are your teammates. And, you know, you may in passing see other teams, but you're in a safe environment. An enclosed environment, and to be able to maintain your focus and not actually go crazy in those environments, to me, had to be very difficult. And when you look at, I'll give, for example, the Big Ten teams who not only were there for their tournament, but those who qualified for the NCAA tournament had to stay in those same hotels or in that same general vicinity within that closed environment for an extra, for those who lasted, for an extra 2 weeks. And you know, they were there for 10 days prior. Mm-hmm. And you have to think that it took a toll on them. You know, a lot of people said that the Big Ten failed by the fact that they didn't reach, you know, any further than, the Elite Eight, considering they were considered the strongest conference in America. But the fact that they were there for a longer period of time had to weigh on them mentally.
For sure. You know, if you go back to the NBA bubble, even some of those players, the professionals, expressed how challenging it was to be in the same place for an extended time.
Yeah.
One thing that stood out to me this season is that it seemed that some of the blue bloods kind of struggled. You know, Michigan State and UNC, they got bounced out in the first round. Kentucky and Duke didn't even make the tournament. Mr. Elmo, do you have a theory on maybe why some of the programs that are more prominent struggled this year?
Well, look at the final two teams that had a nice mix of mature players, players who had already been through at least one season, maybe two seasons of college basketball. And I suspect that maturity certainly helped them, as I said, maintain their sanity, if you will.
Yeah.
And also think that, again, throughout the season, not playing in front of crowds, I think it took its toll on the less experienced teams and many of the blue blood teams, because they've lost players through one and done, you know, are still younger and less experienced in the long run, highly talented, but less experienced. And I've always said, I'll take a good experienced player over a very talented, inexperienced player anytime.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, if you go play, if you sign on to play at Duke, you know, you thinking about Cameron Indoor, the Cameron Crazies, and then you show up and those bright lights are not there, it could be some sort of a letdown.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's part of the issue. So I think that you recognize, you know, you have to rely on that maturity, that experience in order to maintain.
Who was the best player in college basketball?
This year?
Yes, sir.
Wow. I'd have to give that a bunch of thought. I mean, there are so many players. Probably Luka Garza, obviously, with the numbers that he put up and the overall dominance. But, you know, you could say that the two guys from Gonzaga.
Right. A lot of people from my way give credit to Kay Cunningham.
I was going to say Cade Cunningham is another. To me, I never pick who's the absolute best player because it's hard to really. It depends on the need.
Yeah.
But from an overall skill experience, overall production standpoint, you know, you can pick some guys. And I say Cunningham was one of them. But Garza, from a production standpoint, a dominant standpoint, has to be the guy.
Who do you believe is the best pro prospect?
Oh, definitely Cunningham. You know, I think Dosunmu from Illinois is pretty good as well. I think Jalen Suggs could be, you know, an outstanding pro as well.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Emma, how would you describe the difference between the college game and the current NBA? Like, what is the difference between those two sports?
It's obviously talent. There's no question about it. I think that the college game, unfortunately, sometimes tries to morph into the pro game. You know, the idea that, you know, there are more players now playing perimeter basketball, you know, the over-reliance on the three, the isolation, if you will.
the isolation? Isolation at which level? At the pro level?
On the pro level.
Right.
You know, because of the talent ability. But you see that, you know, kind of sneaking into the college game. There's so much of it. You know, I think that, again, the talent level on the pro side is really the difference maker. As far as strategic and tactical, there's so much that the pros are borrowed from by the college game that in some ways it's interchangeable, but the difference is the production and the execution.
Do you have a favorite coach in the college game? One you think
is... there are a lot of guys. A lot of guys I know personally, a lot of guys that I like. I don't have any real favorites. Right. I like what a lot of guys bring to the table. You can go from Tom Izzo to Tommy Amaker to, I could go down the list in just about every conference and mention a guy who's a friend or who certainly has taught well. And that's really the kind of guys I like, guys who are teachers, who understand the nuance of the game and pass that on to the players and not just, turn them out there and say, go play.
Right.
Because sometimes, which there are some of those as well.
For sure. And I go back to Roy Williams, recently retired from the University of North Carolina. And over the last 2 years, I thought that the game was passing him by. I thought he was struggling to communicate to his players. I thought that he was, after games, after some tough losses, he kind of lacked accountability. So it was interesting when he retired and he said, you know what, I don't think I'm the man for the job anymore. And even when I look around at Calipari and some of these other individuals, I wonder, like, are they basketball minds or are these just guys that win a popularity contest can accumulate talent? Because Calipari, he went his last two programs, Memphis and UMass, he left them with NCAA sanctions. So I'm trying to figure out what makes a good coach.
Well, for the most part, a successful coach is made primarily by recruiting. It really is about the players that you get. And John Calipari has lived off of that to the greatest extent. He's always been able to attract the best players out there. And then give him some credit, he's molded them. Now, the problem I have with John often is I don't hear enough about education when you talk about his programs. On the other hand, I look at a guy, like I said, like Tony Bennett, who has, built programs without having the absolute blue chip players and won a championship. He's also lost a historic game as well, but that kind of perseverance with the same team tells me something about, his coaching ability. There are others out there. I look at the new bloods, if you will. Juwan Howard has been tremendous to bring, pro mentality to a great extent, individual development, but molding teams and working on fundamentals and being able to, fold all of those things in and bring a terrific mix that's going to attract some terrific players down the road. So there are varied and different types of coaching that's out there. But the guys that I truly appreciate are the teachers, as I said.
Absolutely. The college game is changing a little bit. One specific rule I have my eye on is this new transfer rule, where players are allowed to transfer to a school and play immediately. In the past, they would have to sit out a year. Mr. Elmo, first, what was the reasoning for having a player sit out a year once they transferred?
Well, I think primarily it's to dissuade players from transferring, to have them make sure that the decision that they made initially was one they were going to stick with, because, otherwise I think oftentimes people thought there would be chaos, that people would be attracted to different schools for a variety of reasons other than the school being an educational fit. Now, we recognize that that's not always the case, but also we also recognize the fairness in, allowing student athletes to make changes. We allow coaches to make changes with no penalties. They don't have to sit out a year if they go from one school to another. And so when you look at the overall attraction of a program, the relationship between a coach and player is important. And so if a coach leaves, certainly why not allow players that same freedom? And this is obviously expanded to giving players freedom to be able to say, I made a mistake, and to go on to another program. I remember this is a one-time thing where you can transfer with impunity at least one time. So, you know, that's given players, you know, college athletes a little more consideration than in the past.
With this new rule, there was over 1,000 players in the transfer portal. You know, looking like the Wild Wild West a bit. How do you feel about the current state allowing athletes to transfer immediately?
That's always going to happen. You know, when you have the new opportunity, everybody's going to want to test it. And as I said, a lot of it has to do with, okay, let me see, you know, what I can get from the new school. Let me see if I can get to a school where, you know, I might have a greater opportunity. Just because they're in the transfer portal doesn't mean they'll actually execute.
Right. This is true. This is true. Who knows what these youngsters even want these days? So, true. Mr. Elmore, someone who went through that process, you came out of Power Memorial High School here in New York. You had, I heard you on another podcast, you had your pick of the litter, because not only did you handle business on the basketball court, but you were handling business in the classroom as well. So you personally, when you were coming out of high school, what were you looking for in a college basketball program and a campus?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, ultimately, I did settle on something. Right. Initially, it was, you know, the relationship with the coaches. And, you know, my sophomore, my junior year, I became close to, you know, the St. John's staff, Coach Carnesecca, his assistant, John Kress. You know, those were guys that, you know, I was a half hour away. I lived a half hour away from St. John's campus. So, you know, I got to know them reasonably well, some of the players on the team, because I got to go up and kind of scrimmage with them. But, you know, as time went on, they had other interests as well. Carnesecca decided he was going to go coach the pros between my junior and senior year. And of course, you know, Lefty Drizel and others stepped into the breach and, you know, kind of reopened my recruiting opportunities. And what I looked for when I visited Maryland and some other schools was an idyllic campus, a real campus, not too far away from home, from New York, where I could get back home when I needed to, but someplace where I could feel as though I was on my own. I wanted to go to a place that, you know, could offer me an education that was, you know, reasonable and respected, but also big time basketball. And having lived in New York during that period of time, the ACC had the game of the week televised up in New York because of so many New Yorkers, you know, like Charlie Scott, Charlie Davis, John Roach, you know, guys like that who went down to ACC school. So, you know, you had a chance to really look at the excitement that ACC schools provided in basketball. You know, obviously at that time they were, you know, beyond reproach as the most exciting conference in America. And they were integrating schools as well. And so Maryland, the northernmost school in the ACC, tucked between two major metropolitan areas of Baltimore and Washington, and particularly two areas that were predominantly Black, you know, I could feel some comfort. And then when I went to the conference, I mean, went to the campus, you could see that it was a beautiful college setting. And, you know, being going to an all boys Catholic school, paid attention to the women as well. And, you know, I decided, you know, this is a perfect place. Notwithstanding the fact that, you know, I enjoyed Lefty Drizel and what he offered with regard to his enthusiasm.
That was as your well coach? As,
yeah, Lefty Drizel was my coach. And the assistant, head assistant was George Raveling, who, you know, African-American role model. He was a guy that was smart, smooth, suave, educated, you know, somebody that you could really look up to. And he was my freshman basketball coach as well. Remember, in those days, freshmen weren't eligible to play in the varsity. And so, you know, you had a number of worlds, a number of boxes that were checked. And, you know, no other school really had that. And so I made my decision to go to Maryland.
Excellent. After making that decision or throughout your tenure, was there ever a time when you doubted that decision? And or was there ever an instance when you remember it confirmed your decision? Like, you know what? I made the right choice.
I've never, ever doubted that I made the right choice going to the University of Maryland. And, you know, confirmation came after I had, you know, broken a bone in my foot and missed the early part of my freshman schedule. You know, the fact that I was still embraced and still, you know, wanted and still challenged academically. And then I went on, played a number of games in my freshman year, and I wrecked my left knee. You know, broke the patella tendon, broke the patella and tore the patella tendon and missed the rest of the season. And yet still treated, you know, as part of the family, not, you know, as damaged goods or anything like that. And even on campus, the embrace, and this was 1970, which is a far cry from now. So, yeah, I mean, I recognize that, you know, I made the right decision simply because of the atmosphere and the sense of belonging that I had. And ultimately, I recovered from those things and went on to have a pretty decent career.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's great to hear you talk about still being wanted after battling some injuries. You talked about the foot. You talked about the other injury. Do you see much of that in today's game? At times, I feel like it's lost. You know, even my humble experience working as a D3 basketball coach or being on the AAU scene, good leaders, that family atmosphere, caring about the welfare of the young athlete seems to be lost.
Yeah, I mean, our values are misplaced now, far more on ultimate results than on development. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to realize college sports is about the development of the individual. Certainly, we all want to win. You know, we all want the accolades that are attendant to winning. But nevertheless, you still got to look at that as part of the education mission. And certainly back in those days, some institutions could look at it as part of the education mission and, you know, help develop young athletes, male and female. But, you know, today, as I said, emphasis on the winning, because winning brings in revenue and, you know, money talks and everything else takes a hike. So I really believe that that's what we have to get back to. You hear all of this talk about, you know, playing this game, college athletes particularly, you hear all this talk about it being labor. You know, that's how the narrative has been hijacked, so you can get to the point of talking pay for play. Because they hijacked the narrative and turned it into labor. When I played, we never even looked at it as labor. We looked at it as an opportunity. And, you know, I think there are so many different areas where the relationship and the treatment of college athletes' relationship with the institutions can be improved. And they certainly can be improved. But nevertheless, we are beneficiaries as college athletes of a terrific opportunity to get a free education. All we have to do is play the game we love and remain eligible in the classroom by challenging ourselves and persevering. So, you know, that's the basis of it. You know, if you want to talk about, you know, so many people making so much money off of our talents, et cetera, let's go after that instead of, you know, ruining the relationship, which pay for play will ultimately ruin the game and relationship with college athletes. Nobody's going to convince me otherwise. And also, particularly as it pertains to Black athletes, it'll change the dynamic to the point where, you know, ultimately we're going to lose that opportunity. But nevertheless, you know, I think that's where the changes need to be made. Maybe we find ways where we don't pay so much money to coaches. And maybe we find ways to take, you know, some of the residual largesse that comes from changing distribution, et cetera, to put it towards the education, the health and safety and well-being of the college athlete to make it a better deal, a more equal deal. Now, I'm not against name, image, and likeness.
Okay.
I believe that that's inherent among us. That is who we are. It's a property right and should never be abrogated. So, you know, the big mistake that the NCAA ever made was to take away the ability for young athletes, college athletes, to capitalize on name, image, and likeness. But, you know, as far as paying for performance, I think that in the long run, that's going to blur the line between college and pros. And quite honestly, as I said, it's going to affect black athletes particularly adversely. There's so many things that we need to do to improve access and education that I think paying just for performance just makes you another pro. And
but Mr. Elmore, when a player who's on campus, in order to play, they have to handle their business academically. What's wrong with them getting a $15,000 stipend, $20,000 stipend for the year while they're playing basketball, generating this income, going to class? How does that hurt them or detract from the black athlete at all?
If that's what it is, $15,000, $20,000, I mean, they're already receiving cost of attendance now that, you know, surpasses $2,000, $3,000, $4,000. If that's all it is, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But you open the floodgates, and now people are getting recruited on the basis of how much money we can give them, which, you know, prior to now, it's always been illegal. Now, there comes a tipping point where you distract from going to class and, you know, earning a college degree. And you focus more on, you know, performing so you can get paid. We have that problem now with the little money and the little benefits that college athletes are getting now that should be getting more benefit. We have that problem where coaches are focusing them too much on performance and playing the game and too little on academic pursuits. And that's adversely affected athletes of color for a long, long time. I mean, look, the graduation rates have improved, and just because you get a diploma doesn't mean that you've gotten an education. But, you know, the graduation rates have improved, and we haven't really paid them a dime for performance. So, you know, things from the educational mission standpoint can get better without actually paying. And I'm not against, you know, balance of the equities. As I said, there are more things, more benefits that can be apply to, you know, student athlete and their presence on campus in playing the game. But to flat out pay salaries, I think, as I said, a huge mistake, because it blurs the distinction between college and the pros. And the next thing you know, you're on campus to earn money as opposed to get an education.
How responsible is the student athlete for their ability to graduate and take advantage of a college campus? You tell your story. You mentioned that you went to campus and you knew what you wanted. Is that fair? You wanted somewhere that was responsible academically.
To an extent. Early, it was also a struggle. I was still immature. It was a period of time before I got hurt. And when I did get hurt, I thought I was there to play basketball. And you know, I was a bit despondent, and grades and attendance fell off. But, you know, then the aha moment comes where you realize all this can be taken away from you. I might not ever play again. When I hurt my knee,
yes,
I had to think about it. I might not ever play again. So what am I going to do now? But yet I still have this opportunity to get a free education. They weren't taking my scholarship away from me. And so when you're talking about the responsibility of your education, it's the institution's responsibility to provide access. But it's the student athlete's responsibility to the greatest extent you can to be an advocate for your education, to stand up. And, you know, oftentimes rules prevent them, coaches' attitudes prevent that. And what I would like to do, and through the Knight Commission and, you know, our all coming report on racial equity, what we'd like to do is remove those barriers and place the onus on the institutions to make it as easy as possible for student athletes to be advocates for their own education and to go forward and get the maximum out of it without any kind of barriers placed before them by coaches or by programs.
Mr. Elmo, can you tell me about the Knight Commission? Because I actually have that written down here. Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics is an organization you are part of. What is that exactly?
Yeah. It's a group of educators and people who've had experience in college athletics as players, as administrators, certainly as fans, but also people. We have presidents who are currently running Division One and Power Five institutions. And we're looking to reform college sports. We recognize that, you know, there are so many problems attendant to college sports today, as opposed to what college sports could be for college athletes. That there's a need to balance the equities, as I spoke of so many times before. And you know, we're looking to find ways that, you know, help institutions, you know, find efforts and to engage in efforts that are going to, you know, make it easier for college athletes to pursue their education, to, you know, make sure that their health, their safety, and their well-being is primary and foremost, as opposed to simply making money. And so over the years, there have been a number of recommendations that we've made that, you know, have been adopted to some extent by the NCAA, but there are an awful lot that haven't been. You know, people, we also are an educational organization. People, there's so many people who don't realize that the NCAA receives no real money from football, Division I football. That's gone through the college football playoff. Right. That's based upon the 1984 Supreme Court case, Board of Regents of Oklahoma versus the NCAA, where they no longer allow the NCAA to control college football. And so, you know, the $500 million per year that the college football playoff makes goes straight to the conferences and then distributed to the institution. Yet the NCAA has to pay for compliance. They have to pay for catastrophic illness costs and injury costs. They have to pay for all of the litigation, even the ones that come from college football. And, you know, essentially, all of those costs are borne by the NCAA and none by those conferences, particularly Power Five conferences, that are, you know, making all of this money from the college football playoff and from television rights. So people put a lot of the blame as far as the inequities on the NCAA, when in effect, there are a lot of areas where they don't even have control over that. Right. So we try to educate people as to, you know, who the villains are. But make no mistake about it. Make no mistake about it that, you know, there are a ton of things that could work to the benefit of college athletes. And yes, more benefits can certainly help them, you know, have a better life on campus and pursue their goals. But as I said, to pay salaries to play the game, and you can call it whatever you want, but there comes a point when it becomes salaries to pay them to play this game, you know, you might as well go become pros. That's why I'm happy there are other opportunities for young people, particularly in basketball, who don't want to necessarily go to college and only go so they can pursue a pro career. Right. There are other outlets now. College should be for people who want to go to college and get a degree.
Absolutely. The Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics, I was going through the website. I believe David Robinson, the former NBAer, is a part of that organization as well.
Yeah, he was. David stepped off not too long ago, but he provided valuable service, certainly.
Excellent. There's some initiatives that you guys have recommended to the NCAA that they have adopted. What are some of those causes?
The most significant one was that to tie revenue distribution for the men's basketball tournament, tie it to academics. Mm-hmm. Hence, you wound up getting the APR, which, you know, measures performance, keeping athletes on track to graduate. And ultimately, you know, you're able to get distribution from the NCAA men's tournament based on, you know, you're keeping a score that's acceptable. And, you know, which means that you have most of your athletes on track, if not all of them, on track to get their degrees. For all too often, you had schools who, you know, had less than 50% of their athletes, you know, on track to graduate within a reasonable time, and yet still performing very well. That's exploitation. Mm-hmm. Performing well in the NCAA tournament and receiving, you know, dollars for that. Now the incentive is to make sure that all of your players are on track to graduate and receiving an education.
What does that APR stand for, sir?
Academic, you got me. Academic performance rating, I believe.
Okay. So schools, they have to make sure their student athletes are working to a degree to some part. or performing to an academic standard.
There's a measurement that allows them that the majority of their athletes are making progress, academic progress towards a degree.
Okay. What are some initiatives that the NCAA hasn't adopted that you would, I guess, tops on your list?
Well, I would think that actually, you know what? I'm not going to preview it. I'm going to ask you to wait. Well, our racial equity task force report is coming up.
Okay.
And so many of those recommendations that we're making right now are contained within that report, and they should be out in the first week of May 2021.
Sounds good. I want to go back to name, image, and likeness. This is something you express support of, players being able to capitalize off their name, image, and likeness. I guess that's being able to do one-off sponsorship deals with businesses. Isn't that a way to pay players? Isn't that kind of in the same ballpark?
No, you're not paying them for performance. They're being paid on the value and the basis that their name carries, within, their particular time on campus. And it's not the institution that's paying them. It's not the NCAA that's paying them. It's a third party, the commercial value that sees the commercial value in that individual. You want to try to make it a little more uniform so that, most athletes, if they do have a name value from playing on a team particularly, that they can all share in that. For instance, the quarterback shouldn't be making that much more money than the left tackle that protects him. And not having the use of the institution's marks means that individual has to stand on what they do. And it's fair to them, and it's also fair to the institution, unless they work a deal where they can use the institution's mark and they share. But for the most part, again, we're talking about something that's personal, that's inherent to that individual, that's their property right, and that they should be able to explore the value of that property right without anybody, abrogating that opportunity.
What's that mean for fair competition?
So there are a lot of guardrails that will prevent people from exploiting the opportunity to do that. But yes, some schools and some opportunities are going to be, more lucrative for some than for others. This is, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it's not socialism. That some people are going to have greater value because of their performance and their commercial value. And that's just the way it is. But everybody will have the opportunity to explore it. And that's the difference. It's not everybody has an opportunity to make a ton of money. It's everybody has the opportunity to explore. Right now, you can't do it unless you forfeit your eligibility.
Okay. Excellent. Mr. Elmore, how did it come to be that you ended up being a prosecutor? I know when I was watching growing up, I used to watch Matlock. He was the defense attorney. He was going to help free the innocent. How did you end up on the side of the prosecution?
Yeah, it's definitely prosecution and not persecution. So let's get that clear. No, actually, I grew up watching Perry Mason. Right. That's what made me want to be a lawyer.
Right.
The fact that I could be a voice for the voiceless, a power for the powerless. And growing up during the civil rights struggle and the war in Vietnam controversy, you thought that the law would make a difference. And so I didn't want to be an attorney, a lawyer, before I wanted to be a pro athlete. But the reality was that once I got to law school, I was working for the public defender in Boston. Mm-hmm. And, you could have a third-year law student conduct what they call a preliminary hearing, which was a hearing before a judge, which would determine whether or not the charges that the prosecution applied were legitimate enough to bind that individual over for trial. And I had one case where I had a client, a defendant, who was charged with aggravated rape, which means utilizing force and intimidation and a weapon.
Yes.
And the victim was on the stand, and I had to tear her story down to show that that wasn't the case. And ultimately in doing so, kind of reduced it to tears. And when it was all over, yes, we were right that the prosecution had overcharged, but I felt terrible. And so in talking to my supervisor, who was a former U.S. attorney, you know, he told me, he said, look, defense attorneys are reactive. You have to react to what the government does. Had you been on the other side with ethics and responsibility, you would have properly charged this individual and we wouldn't have had to do this. And so he says that the prosecution is proactive. And that's what made me think, you know what? You know, maybe that's what I need to be doing. I need to be making sure that the scales are even. And quite honestly, in my third year paper, which was about peremptory challenges and how they were abused by prosecutors many times against Black defendants, where, you know, they would peremptorily challenge, which means you can challenge without any reason at all, peremptorily challenge jurors on any basis. Usually that means getting rid of all the Black jurors when there's a Black defendant.
Yeah.
You know, I there was a case called Batson, which outlawed that. And, you know, the great Thurgood Marshall wrote the opinion. And so I wrote my third year paper supporting that and going a step further and saying maybe the prosecution doesn't need any peremptorial challenges since they are the government and they have the greatest amount of resources. I found out that only one prosecutor filed an amicus, a friend of the court brief, in support of Batson. Just one prosecutor in America.
Wow.
And that was Elizabeth Holtzman in Brooklyn, New York, my home borough. And I said to myself, you know, based on the fact that, you know, prosecutors need to be proactive in doing justice, not merely convicting, and only one prosecutor who happened to be in my hometown did it, I could work for her. And so I made that choice. Had it not been for that, I might not have been on the prosecution side. And so, you know, as an assistant district attorney in Brooklyn, I certainly handled misdemeanors and felony cases and tried a number of them and had some success. But ultimately, I wound up in the bureau that tried police misconduct.
Wow.
And so much of the same stuff that's going on today, we were doing back, you know, 30 some odd years ago. And quite honestly, the sad part about it is things haven't changed. The only thing that's changed, and I look at the George Floyd situation and so many others, thank God for video.
Yes, sir.
You know, because in the Chauvin case, in the Chauvin trial, had there not been video, I'm not sure he would have been convicted.
Correct.
Because juries and judges now are loath to nullify evidence that they can see and that others can see. You know, that all began with Rodney King, and we know what happened there. But as time goes on, when people can visibly see and viscerally feel what happened, quite honestly, you know, they'll make different decisions. Yeah, what it was in my day, it was the word of the complaining victim, who usually was somebody with a record, which was irrelevant to the fact that they were beaten.
Yes.
Or shot, against the word of the police officer. And people gave the police officers absolute deference. Even judges did. I had one case where I had forensic evidence, scientific evidence that proved that the cop lied. And the judge totally dismissed it and still found the officer not guilty. And people got to remember, not guilty doesn't mean you're innocent.
Right.
And the judge's excuse was, well, I didn't believe your complaining witness. So it tells you that people aren't willing to jeopardize these police officers on the word of somebody who might have had a criminal record, even if the cop was wrong. And so thank God today for video, where, you know, that throws that kind of reasoning out the window and you can see for yourself what happened. When Walter Scott was shot in Charleston, if it wasn't for the video that the cop didn't know, he might not have been convicted because he lied and said Walter Scott attacked him. When in effect, Walter Scott was running away and got shot. We'll see what happens in Atlanta. We'll see what happens with the young man who was shot during the Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. There's so many now that have video or body cams that will prove something beyond what the police officers said. So, You know, you asked me that, why did I become a prosecutor? Primarily, it was because of that. Ultimately, I did go into private practice. I did more sports law. I did some defense work because, you know, the government doesn't pay. And I was getting ready to raise a family. And, you know, we had to find another way to make a living, my wife and I.
Yes.
But it was a good experience and, you know, helped inform me of so many things that are going on today.
Absolutely. Looking at your story, you know, and I saw that you had worked as a prosecutor, I start to look at that position differently. Because, again, the prosecution is for the people, you know, and
right.
that's a power that is mighty. We should look at that position as well as something to strive for. You mentioned the George Floyd.
If you're doing right, right, and that's the problem. There's so much power involved. There are a lot of prosecutors out there who just want to build levels of conviction so they can move on for their personal, you know, self and their self-aggrandizement for their personal gain to move on in politics. You know, good prosecutors are the ones who are going to try to do justice, as I said, not merely convict.
Absolutely, overcharging people, all type of crazy stuff. Ms. Thelma, what did you make of the Chauvin trial and ultimately the verdict?
Well, as I said, thank God for video, because, you know, I shudder to think what would have happened had we not had that. But, you know, it just demonstrates if the prosecution takes their job seriously, which Keith Ellison absolutely did and his team, you know, they can ultimately convict. That's one of the biggest problems. All too often, prosecution of police misconduct is handled by people who have direct contact with those officers every single day.
Yes, sir.
And so, you know, whether people want to admit it or not, there is a level of collusion and collegiality that prevents them. I look at Kenosha County when, what's the brother's name? Jacob Blake. Was shot. Mm-hmm. There's no way in the world that case would not, one, have been presented to a grand jury, you know, had that been in my day. And secondly, with the video that was shot, I think charges would have been brought. A prosecutor in a grand jury situation can marshal the evidence and almost in every case get an indictment if they truly believe that an indictment is warranted. But in Kenosha County, you know, they decided they didn't want to prosecute that police officer. Not only is that police officer back to work, getting paid.
Yes.
But, you know, there's no recourse for Jacob Blake except in a civil sense. And, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, look what happened most recently in Elizabeth City, where they won't even show the family the full video, body cam video, right, of how the gentleman got shot. You know, there's one of the biggest reasons there is because even in a civil suit, they could bankrupt that county. You know, that's a small county. And that's one of them, let alone have those police officers tried in a criminal sense for murder. So there's an awful lot. When you say what I've made of the Chauvin trial, there's an awful lot of work to be done.
Yes.
It seems as though within the last couple of months that, you know, the police officers are in some way, shape or form trying to get in their last licks before legislative reform comes. But it's coming.
Yeah. I saw a video of Jesse Jackson listening to the verdict. He was rather emotional. Mr. Elmer, when I see situations like this, police-involved shooting with unarmed black men, I kind of turn inward and want to focus my energies on equipping the young men in my community with the tools to stay out of the way, right, of the police. And sometimes that conversation is rejected. They blame me for, assigning culpability to the victims of those incidents. That's not the case. You know, there's always going to be evil in the world. I just want to try to equip my people with the tools necessary to stay out of the way. How fair is it for people to reject that conversation?
It's ignorant to the extent that, you know, you're not looking to try to get people to escape the justice and to escape legitimate police inquiry. But you're trying to keep them out of situations where, you know, an investigation of whether you have registration that's expired in your car turns into you know, a situation where the police have to use their guns. You know, that's stupid. And so, one, you want to make sure that people are in compliance. But even when they're in compliance, they can be stopped. And so from that standpoint, not only do you have to make responses, you know, more legitimate from that area, from the police, but you also have to take a look at policing as a whole. And I think, you know, yes, we need to put money, more money into communities where young people aren't put in a position that allow people to even legitimately think that they could present a danger. You know, you got to take guns off the street. You got to invest more in, you know, jobs and education, et cetera. But even then, some of the most educated and career-minded men of color get stopped. Mm-hmm. And so now you also have to reimagine policing and recognizing that, you know, the job of the police is to de-escalate, not to escalate situations. That in situations where there's mental illness, where there's domestic violence, that there are ways to de-escalate those things instead of escalate. Right now, cops are taught, you know, how to gain control, mm-hmm. how to maintain authority. And oftentimes that goes overboard. You look in jurisdictions like Oakland and Camden, New Jersey, Oakland, California, Camden, New Jersey, and other places where they've taught police to be able to treat situations like that in a way where they're to defuse the situation instead of light the fuse. Right. Where in a mental health situation, it's not only police that are sent, but also mental health experts. So yeah, we've got to reimagine not only how we treat our young folks and how we educate them, but we also got to find ways we reimagine and rethink how we want to be policed. And that's up to the community. That's not up to the police officers. You know, it's up to the community. And the communities have to start taking control, both on a local, state, and even federal level.
How do we start to do that?
Well, I mean, there are laws right now that are being proposed that get rid of qualified immunity and, you know, make sure that police understand that they personally are responsible, not the states, when they violate somebody's constitutional rights in that regard. You find ways that limit the use of deadly force and make people criminally culpable for violating, you know, that limitation on the use of deadly force. You find ways, again, to take money away from militarizing police forces and put that money into ways that teach them how to de-escalate situations and to add more, you know, kind of community-based solutions, whether it's mental health experts, because so many people, there's a study that talks about the high percentage of people with mental illness that ultimately wind up getting shot and or killed by the police, when in effect, if somebody with the expertise in handling the mentally unstable would have had a better chance of de-escalating the situation. You got to find ways to, you know, deploy those folks instead of, you know, armed police officers in many instances. There are so many ways to reimagine policing, and they're out there. It's just that, again, we have a society with a mentality that thinks that the police have to be the buffer, that they can solve crime. And really, they do solve crime after the crime has occurred. And they don't necessarily stop crime.
Yeah.
Too often, police come after the crime has occurred.
Yes, sir.
And then it's too late. So, you know, like I said, with this show, it's going to be hard to go into, you know, the nuance and the details of different types of policing, but we can get it done. Hopefully, I just outlined a few of the areas that we need to look at and, you know, some of the things we need to propose.
Yes, sir. Mr. Elmo, I wanted to reference one of the pieces you wrote in USA Today. This came out August 27, 2014. It says, Len Elmore, after Ferguson, black athletes must speak. And one of the first lines is, every athlete, particular black athletes, ought to remember the date, June 4, 1967. Mr. Elmore, what took place on that date?
I believe you're talking about the summit that Jim Brown convened that brought, you know, Hall of Fame athletes in football and in basketball particularly to talk about, you know, economic opportunity that needs to be, you know, created for Black community, but also to listen to Muhammad Ali and understand his position as a conscientious objector, as Ali was sacrificing his heavyweight crown and ultimately risking going to jail for refusing to be inducted into the army during the war in Vietnam. And the reason they need to understand that is because it's all about leadership. Mm-hmm. It's all about unity. Howard Bryant, who wrote the book, The Heritage, made a statement that I fully believe in. The most powerful employee in America is the Black athlete. Mm-hmm. And if people were to really think about that, the only way that comes true is if you act in unity. Mm-hmm. And so the impact that they can have on owners who are all billionaires in a vanity-based industry, you know, those same people employ lobbyists to get them zoning laws changed, to get tax advantages, to get so many different things that would provide advantage to their teams in their arenas. You know, they could deploy those same lobbyists to change the laws as we just talked about, getting rid of qualified immunity, changing the use of deadly force, you know, making some of these communities whole with regard to the subjugation that they've suffered by the police, as well as, you know, redirecting resources that are going to, you know, help change communities, that are going to provide jobs and wealth building and keep people from being food insecure and so many different things. You know, right now, by way of example, you know, you look at the NBA owners who purportedly are the most progressive, and even NFL owners who are a little more or more conservative. And on one hand, they say they support the players in their push for social justice. Right. But when you look at the elected officials and the candidates to whom they donate, overwhelmingly, they've donated to those candidates who support voter suppression and some of the other laws that are antithetical to equal rights. And so, you know, you've got to be able to put pressure on them some way, shape, or form. And the only way athletes can do it is in a unified fashion, not on an individual basis. And, you know, as I said, that's a lot of ammunition for another show. I'm not sure we have time for that right now.
Okay. Yeah, because I've been reading, trying to get a hold of the history. And June 4th, as you mentioned, it was Muhammad Ali, it was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, it was Bill Russell, you know, some of the best athletes in the world. And you went on in that article and you said, I quote, "I wish that there was a similar defining moment for today's Black athlete," end quote. Mr. Elmore, why hasn't it happened? And how do we get them to want to unify, to have the will to do so?
I'm not sure there's a strong enough personality like Jim Brown was. I'm not sure that, you know, that these young men and even some of the young women recognize the strength that they have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because they can't act in unity, they're fearful that if they act individually, that they'll be the ones that'll be struck down and have something taken away from them. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want to put their livelihood at risk. Let's face it. When you're making $35, $40 million, there are a lot of things you can do, but you're only going to step up to the line. You're not necessarily going to put yourself at risk. But collectively, I think that they would more than have the power. So they also require some leadership. They need somebody to step up, explain how to use this power, how to pull these levers, and, you know, ultimately put the pressure, you know, on those who have the power for change. So
there's such a great history of revolutionary athletes. I read a book recently, Oscar Robertson sued the NBA, Kurt Flood sued for the right to be a free agent, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar skipped out on the Olympics. Where did the, I guess, fracture happen where we no longer have that type of athlete? Like, where was the lineage kind of like broken?
When they started paying big money. You know, people talk about Michael Jordan when he said that Republicans buy my shoes also, symbolically, even though he said he was just joking. But symbolically, that's where it comes from. That, as I said, individuals don't want to put at risk, and it's not incumbent. Let me say that from the outset. It's not incumbent upon any individual athlete or even any collective to say, you know, we're going to sacrifice and put at risk our ability to make a great living and to have the following that we have. They don't have to do that. Nobody's saying they do. I just believe that, you know, if I were in those shoes and I could, you know, and I could push myself up 40 years to today as an athlete in the NBA, that, you know, I might have more to say to my colleagues. I might have more to say socially as to what we need to do. So, you know, that's really what it comes down to. Again, it's a question of leadership. It's a question of desire. Right now, what the media does, and it's kind of slick that they, you know, they laud guys for speaking up and saying these things. But, you know, as long as they don't step over the line and actually, you know, have a work stoppage. And that's important because an executive that I know that's working with one of the most popular leagues, and they'll go unnamed, said that the only thing the owners understand and the only thing they fear is work, is business interruption. That's the only thing. But who's willing to do it? You can't do it individually. It's got to be a collective. And the unions won't do it because the unions are going to make their money from the licensing and also the payment from the players' dues. The players won't do it, obviously, right now because they're fearful if they step out there and, you know, others don't follow, that they'll be the ones that are sacrificed. And we've seen that happen to guys, you know, like Craig Hodges, Mahmoud Raouf, people like that, who've been blackballed, Colin Kaepernick. And, you know, quite honestly, agents won't advise their players to do it because if the players don't get paid, agents don't get paid. You know, it's really centers around dollars once again. And, you know, how much is it worth? So players can do what they can do without without jeopardizing their living, because we've seen that society will take that away from you, as they did Ali and others on an individual basis, Kurt Flood and others. Society will take that away from you if you step too far over the line. But those things are important. And I think, again, that, you know, the leadership that athletes require, you look behind you, I see the revolt of the black athlete.
Sure,
Harry Edwards was one of those kinds of leaders.
Yes, indeed.
I'm not sure there's a Harry Edwards out there that can capture the imagination as well as the fierceness that athletes can act with in order to try to institute change. And if he or she is out there, you know, they need to step forward now while, you know, the leverage is good.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the great Len Elmore. Sir, thank you so much.
All right, man.
All right, take
My
care.
My pleasure.